Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for June 24th, 2011. I'm Stuart Wills. This week, dinosaur temperature regulation, how infants draw causal inferences, and the future of battery technology. All this plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
A paper published online this week by Science provides new data for an old question. How did the huge dinosaurs of the Mesozoic regulate their body temperatures? Using a novel twist on isotopic analysis of fossil teeth, Robert Eagle and colleagues report that the sauropod dinosaurs, the largest land animals that have ever lived, apparently had body temperatures similar to those of modern mammals and birds. While the study doesn't resolve the long-standing debate about whether dinosaurs were warm-blooded, cold-blooded, or some kind of hybrid, it does place new constraints on the question and points to some intriguing new directions for study. I spoke with the paper's senior author, Robert Eagle, from his office at Caltech.
My work is really focused on what's really one of the most long-standing debates in paleobiology, which is whether dinosaurs were cold-blooded organisms which derive their body heat from the environment and so would be more similar to modern crocodiles or alligators. Alternatively, were they warm-blooded organisms like modern mammals and birds that generate their body heat internally and have relatively high body temperatures? Another alternative possibility is that they had some sort of intermediate physiology. And certainly from an evolutionary biology point of view, they're interesting because they're really like the ancestors of modern birds. So we're interested to know at what point did high metabolism and high body temperatures evolve in the lineage that eventually led to modern birds. In our study, we applied a new approach to this very old question, using a technique that allows us to take effectively a direct measurement of dinosaur body temperatures by analyzing the chemistry of fossil teeth up to 150 million years old. And the type of dinosaur that we studied was sauropod dinosaurs, which are the gigantic long-necked dinosaurs that most people are probably familiar with. And they're actually the largest terrestrial animal that's ever lived.
Well, before we get into the details of the work, I had thought it was pretty well accepted at this point that dinosaurs were endothermic or warm-blooded. Can you take me through that controversy and why this is still sort of a bone of contention in this field?
Yeah, I mean, I think many people do think that dinosaurs may have been endothermic, but I don't think a consensus opinion has been reached. Some people have argued that if particularly large dinosaurs had very high metabolism like mammals, you might find that they would have severe problems with overheating. As I said, some of these dinosaurs are the largest terrestrial animals that have ever lived, and so you could imagine that overheating could be a problem for them.
Just because there's so much mass there.
Yeah, exactly. And also, environmental temperatures were probably somewhat warmer than they are today during the time that dinosaurs lived. Alternatively, people have argued that dinosaurs could have had relatively low metabolic rates compared to modern mammals and birds, but they could have had relatively warm body temperatures just because they retain heat. So it's not just a question of cold blood versus warm blood. You could be warm but have a low metabolic rate just because you're so large. From a historical point of view, when dinosaurs were first discovered, they were really mainly portrayed as kind of slow, lumbering reptiles, much like modern crocodiles and alligators. And it wasn't until maybe the 1960s or 70s that people began to argue that maybe their endothermy or warm-bloodedness would be more consistent with observations people made about dinosaurs, for example, predator-prey ratios in the fossil record or models of running speeds based on fossil footprints. But despite, you know, 20 or 30 years of this debate, there's not really a consensus opinion being reached on this question.
Well, let's look at how your work casts light on this. I gather that you were trying to get at this problem of the temperature regulation of large dinosaurs, irrespective of, you know, endothermy versus exothermy. How did you actually attack this problem?
Our approach is to study the chemistry of fossils. And basically, we thought we could unlock information about the physiology of dinosaurs from the chemistry of fossil teeth and bones. Our technique is focused on the analysis of isotopes. So many elements of the periodic table of different isotopes, which is basically an atom that has the same number of protons but a different number of neutrons in the nucleus. So it's the same element, but it would have a different atomic mass. And as isotopes have different atomic masses, they have slightly different chemical properties, and this is what we exploit in our study. So, for example, all the carbon in the Earth has a common isotope which has a mass of 12, so carbon-12, which comprises about 99% of all carbon. But also about 1% of carbon is carbon-13, a slightly heavier isotope. And so our approach is a relatively new way of looking at isotopes, which is namely looking at the bonding of rare heavy isotopes of carbon and oxygen together in a mineral that contains a carbonate moiety.
So you're looking not just at the behavior of one isotope, but of the behavior of two together.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it turns out that the amount of carbon-13 bonded to oxygen-18, which is the heavy isotope of oxygen, is directly proportional to the temperature at which a mineral grows. So a mineral that precipitates cold temperatures, you'll find that there's more carbon-13 bonded to oxygen-18 than in a mineral that grew at a hotter temperature. Therefore, we can use this phenomenon as an effective thermometer. We call it a clumped isotope thermometer, as we're effectively measuring the clumping of heavy isotopes together. And so it turns out that we can make these type of measurements on apatite, which is the mineral that makes up teeth and bone. So we can effectively make measurements of the body temperature of an extinct species from their fossil teeth, even when something has been dead for millions of years.
And so what did this clumped isotope analysis tell you specifically about the body temperatures of these sauropods you were studying?
So the body temperatures that we measured were in the range of 36 to 38 degrees C, which is a kind of very interesting temperature range. It's very similar to the body temperatures of modern mammals and dissimilar to the body temperatures of modern crocodiles and alligators, which you might expect to be around 26 to 30 degrees C. This doesn't necessarily mean that these large dinosaurs had high metabolism like mammals and birds. As I said before, they could have been gigantosaurs and so warm because they are so large. But our analysis really allows us to rule out the fact that they could have been cold like crocodiles, for example.
So the temperature could have been coming from their enormous mass, but they still need some way to kind of keep their temperature regulated. Is that it?
Yeah, some models of the physiology of sauropods have actually predicted that they might have been gigantotherms, so their body temperature may have scaled with their mass, and they actually predicted that sauropod body temperatures could be well over 40 degrees. And our measured body temperatures are somewhat lower than these models, and one interpretation of that could be that sauropods developed adaptations to prevent these kind of very excessively high body temperatures being reached by having physiological adaptations to disperse body heat, or possibly also behavioral adaptations to stop them getting too hot.
Well, you were looking, as you say, at fossil tooth material from more than 100 million years ago. I would imagine that it's rather difficult to work with that kind of material. You have to worry about alteration of the teeth after burial, for example. How do you control for those sorts of factors?
And this is really one of the big challenges of this type of work that we had to confront. We took a number of steps to try and ensure that we were working with a material that preserved some primary information. Firstly, we looked at tooth enamel, which from a mineralogical point of view is the best material to study. It's comprised of very large crystals that are very tightly packed together. It doesn't have much organic material inside. And all of these things mean that it's less likely to be chemically altered. And a lot of previous work has shown that it can preserve primary chemical signals even over tens of millions of years. We also made a variety of different chemical and microscopic analysis to try and determine whether the specimens that we were analyzing were preserved. And in the end, we rejected a portion of the samples that we analyzed as probably being altered, and we selected a subset that we had a good evidence that they may be preserving original chemical signals.
So where would you say this work leaves this kind of larger debate on, you know, endothermy versus exothermy, and what do you think are sort of the next steps in addressing that debate?
The evidence we present in our paper really argues that these particular dinosaur taxa were not cold like alligators and crocodiles. It also argues they weren't very hot which kind of argues against some of the more extreme models of gigantothermy. I think part of the exciting aspect of this paper is really that it opens up an enormous amount of possible follow-up work. I mean, really, from any extinct taxa that you have well-preserved teeth material, you could potentially make a body temperature measurement. So if you wanted to ask whether gigantothermy was the physiology of sauropods, you could then go on and make measurements from juvenile sauropods and compare them to adults and see whether there was a relationship with body temperature. You could start to interrogate some of the iconic evolutionary transitions series between dinosaurs and birds to try and see when warm-bloodedness and body temperature was related to the development of flight. You could also interrogate the transition from cynodont therapsids to mammals, and that would be a very exciting set of experiments to do as well. So there's a lot of follow-up work that can be done using this technique.
Rob Eagle, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Robert Eagle is lead author of a paper that places new constraints on dinosaur body temperatures. You can find the paper online at www.scienceexpress.org. It's a problem that humans face every day, determining whether a given outcome is the result of our own actions or the effect of something else in the environment. But how does such rational inference come about? And how early in life? A paper by Yo-Wen Guan and Laura Schultz of MIT, published in this week's Science, suggests that humans have the ability to draw such inferences at a very early age indeed, as early as 16 months after birth, and that infants make these distinctions using a form of statistical reasoning. Science's Andrew Green has more on the story.
Laura Schultz is interested in what she calls a particularly hard problem of being a human being.
Which is the problem that any time you act in the world, your own actions are entangled with the world out there. And it can be very hard to know how to make causal attributions in that context. We're interested in whether infants were sensitive to this problem, whether they could solve this problem and take rational actions after making causal attributions in this context. And we were also interested in whether babies could do this using very sparse statistical evidence.
To get at that problem, Schultz and grad student Yuwen Guan designed an experiment to see if 16-month-old babies could distinguish between two failure conditions involving a small toy. In one condition, the babies watched as several adults pushed a button on the toy and caused it to play a tune, then pushed the button again and failed to make the toy play the tune.
This kind of evidence suggests there's something wrong with the toy. No matter which experimenter tries it, the toy does not work reliably.
In the other case, the babies saw one adult succeed in activating the toy several times, then hand the toy to another adult who failed repeatedly to make the toy activate. That's a clear indication that when the toy failed, the problem was with the person operating the toy rather than the toy itself. Where things got interesting is when the babies were then handed the toy. Under the experimental design, Schultz says, the toy was cleverly rigged to present the babies with a quandary.
The baby always failed. When the baby tried to push the button, the toy never worked. And what we wanted to know was whether babies would use that little bit of statistical data about the distribution of outcomes across experimenters to determine whether the problem was probably due to the toy or probably due to themselves.
In fact, the 16-month-old babies did just that, presented with the initial data suggesting that the toy worked and any problem probably rested with the person using it. The babies, upon the toy's failure, handed the toy to a parent, perhaps seeking help. When the initial condition suggested that the problem might be in the toy itself, however, the baby simply rejected the toy and reached for another one to try their luck again. According to Schultz, this kind of inferential reasoning from limited data suggests that a rich and powerful learning mechanism is at play, even at a very early stage in cognitive development.
Babies are engaged in rational learning. These are 16-month-old babies. They're still in diapers. They are still dependent on their parents for virtually everything. And yet they're trying to achieve their goals. They're attending to evidence that's relevant to those goals. And they take evidence-based actions. The things that they do to try to solve problems and fulfill their intentions are sensitive to the statistics of the environment around them. And that's sort of impressive claims about a 16-month-old baby.
The children are learning something quite profound, which is, what's the difference between the consequences of my own actions on the world and just the way the world is?
Allison Gopnik, who is not an author on this study, is a professor of childhood cognitive development at the University of California at Berkeley, and the author of The Philosophical Baby, What Children's Minds Tell Us About Truth, Love, and the Meaning of Life.
And an idea that we had quite a while ago is the idea of thinking about babies and young children as being like little scientists who are going around the world and making up theories and figuring out the world from the data the way that scientists do. This is really the youngest that we've shown babies are inferring these important things about the world from just a pattern of statistics.
Gopnik also notes that while recent studies of early childhood development collect results based on looking time, observing how long a baby's gaze lingers on a certain point,
one of the things that's very nice about the study was using the 16-month-old's actions, their attempts to fix something, to interpret what they were thinking.
Laura Schultz points out, however, that making these attributions in real life is rarely as simple as the scenario presented in the experiment.
The most clear limitation of the study is that babies certainly never get evidence or information in a form that is as clean and precise as the way we present it. In the real world, the babies have to pick up on information about all sorts of events simultaneously.
Both Schultz and Gopnik believe that the study's results raise some new and exciting questions about the way young children learn about the world.
I think that the implications are to suggest the power of the kinds of learning mechanisms that are in place quite early in development. They suggest also a lot of interesting questions about what babies do in terms of supporting their own learning.
The question we can ask now is, what do babies start out knowing? What do they learn? And maybe most importantly, how do these incredibly powerful learning mechanisms work that actually enable babies to really be the greatest learning creatures that we know of in the universe?
The learning mechanism described in this study gives new insights into how humans, especially very young humans, are able to make reasoned decisions given the wealth of data they're exposed to every day. But, says Gopnik, we still have a long way to go to fully understand this complex issue.
There's more and more work to be done to figure out exactly how is it that the babies are using the information in the world to draw inferences and to draw conclusions, and just how abstract and complicated conclusions can they actually draw.
Schultz hopes to fill in some of those missing parts of the picture in her own work.
This study really looked at how babies are exploring things in the world, but a lot of what we do in thinking and learning is exploring the ideas in our mind. We take those and we muse those in different ways, and we put those to use to solve different problems. And I think that the way we would like research to go in our lab is to look at how babies do those intermediary steps, how once they have a concept, they can then deploy it and redeploy it to solve new kinds of problems. And I hope that's the direction our research continues to pursue.
For Science, this is Andrew Green.
You can read the paper by Yo-Wen Guan and Laura Schultz, 16-month-olds rationally infer the causes of failed actions, in this week's Science. In a News Focus article this week in Science, news writer Robert Service reports on work currently underway in labs around the world to improve battery technologies, work largely stoked by the need for better power sources for next-generation electric cars. I asked him what has made finding power sources for these vehicles such a tough problem.
Well, mainly because the demands are so high. You need to store so much energy on board a car in order to propel it. So that's a very big challenge. But the potential market is vast as well, because if car makers and battery makers were to succeed at that, you can potentially sell millions of cars. And there's been quite a few studies that have looked at what markets might emerge if these future batteries succeed. And folks do indeed project by 2030, say, there could be millions and tens of millions of electric cars on the road. Among the drivers are things that we're all somewhat aware of these days, things like climate change, lots of CO2 in the atmosphere, energy security, being able to ensure supplies of either petroleum or other forms of fuel for transportation, and cost. And as energy prices go up, that's increasing interest in electric vehicles.
Well, you do mention cost, and you talk a little bit about the current costs of power sources for electric vehicles, which seem to be rather prohibitive.
Yeah, today's lithium-ion cells probably cost $600 to $700 a kilowatt hour. And so that's not such a big problem when all you have to do is use a little tiny bit of it to power a telephone. But if you're going to be putting giant bricks of this in your cars, it's going to get really expensive. Now, the Department of Energy, the U.S. Department of Energy, has put a goal out there that says batteries for vehicles should cost less than $250 per kilowatt hour. And for grid storage, which is the idea of storing electricity for the electrical grid, they want to get even lower, below $100. Those are big challenges. So that's going to be another part of this whole story. And I think that's why what we're seeing today is we're just seeing a slow rollout of the use of batteries as propulsion in cars. And so I think most of us are probably familiar with hybrid gas electric vehicles, and that's where you would have a small battery. You also have a gasoline engine that's really going to be doing most of the propulsion. So the hope is over time, those battery capacities will grow and prices will come down, which will let the battery take on more and more of a role of driving the car, propelling the car, and ultimately, if you have good enough batteries, you can dispense with fossil fuels altogether.
But looking at battery technology right now, it seems like the principles underlying that technology haven't really changed much in the past, I don't know, several hundred years.
They really haven't, and that's because it's just driven by basic chemistry, and that never changes. So you can try different combinations of different elements and different compounds as your battery components, but the principles don't change about how batteries work and what the potential capacity is for different materials. There are plenty of scientific challenges, but it's really, if you want to think of it almost as an engineering challenge of trying to get these various combinations of materials to work in conjunction with each other.
And so what are some of the things researchers are doing now to try to trick out these traditional batteries?
Well, so I think most of us are probably familiar or have heard about batteries called lithium-ion batteries, and these are becoming the workhorse technology today. There still are many other types of batteries out there. For example, nickel metal hydride batteries are probably still more common in hybrid electric vehicles, but companies are moving towards putting lithium-ion cells in vehicles. That's a newer technology. There are a bunch of variations of it. So just one step back to a primer is that batteries have different components in them. You have two electrodes. One's called an anode, which is negatively charged during discharge, and you have a cathode, which is positively charged. So these metals at the two electrodes have a different desire, if you will, to hold on to electrons. And so that's when you connect a wire to them or create an electric circuit, it causes electrons to flow from the anode to the cathode, and then that drives ions through typically a liquid in the battery called an electrolyte. So in today's lithium-ion cells, you get quite a number of different combinations of materials for the anodes and cathodes. For example, lithium cobalt oxide is a very common cathode material, and you might use graphite or something like that for the anode. And so today's lithium-ion cells, they have an energy capacity that scientists refer to in units called watt-hours per kilogram. That's the standard yardstick or measuring stick that everybody uses to compare their batteries. So conventional lithium-ion batteries today have a storage capacity of about 120, 140 watt-hours per kilogram. That's probably enough to get a car something on the order of 40, 50, 60, up to 100 miles in range. The hope is that changes to some of these materials in the anode and particularly in the cathode can drive that storage capacity all the way up to 200. So that's not bad. It's almost double. But in order to truly be a revolutionary technology that a lot of people would like to see, the general thought is that you need to drive that even higher, maybe even five times higher, so all the way up to like 1,000 watt-hours per kilogram. We're nowhere near that yet, but that's the hope, and there is real potential for some of these materials to do that.
Okay, so what are some of these materials?
I can just run through a couple real quickly. One, if we're looking beyond lithium-ion batteries, one is something called lithium sulfur. And this is where you would use pure lithium metal as the anode material and sulfur as the the cathode material. And typically, when researchers work on this, they sort of encapsulate bits of sulfur in tiny porous carbon. That works better. The potential there is that has a capacity of, theoretically, about 2,500 watt-hours per kilogram. Now, no battery ever reaches its theoretical potential. In fact, there's sort of a rule of thumb that battery makers use is that when it comes to the products that you and I buy and batteries we put on our cell phones or maybe one day in our cars, our capacity of those cells is typically one quarter of the theoretical energy potential. So if lithium sulfur has a theoretical potential of, say, 2,500, then maybe it's safe to say we could get 600 watt-hours per kilogram out of it. That's just still pretty good. That might get you, 300, 400 miles in a range. That's similar to some gasoline engines today. So another possible one is something they call a lithium air battery.
A lithium air battery. That sounds kind of exotic.
Yeah, this is a case in which they don't actually have a cathode. They use oxygen from the air to come in. It's a porous battery, so it allows oxygen to come in and uses that as its cathode material. And that has a theoretical capacity of, some people will put that number at 3,500 or 5,000 watt-hours per kilogram. There are variables that different people work with here. But if you then do the math on that one, maybe you can get to 1,000 realistically if you can get that technology to work. Again, gives you a pretty good range.
You talk about if you can get these technologies to work. Is there any way to forecast how long it's going to be before we start to see some of these more exotic batteries?
I think it's fair to say that the lithium sulfur and lithium air are still several years away, if not more. There are many challenges with them to get these materials to work. Some of the more advanced lithium ion ones to get up maybe to 200 watt hours per kilogram, those look a little more doable at this point. One of the big challenges in some of these new battery chemistries is you can get a bunch of different chemical reactions that take place within your battery that wind up killing your battery or can be unsafe and be dangerous. So researchers really are working hard to try to learn what combinations of materials can make those batteries safer and also durable.
Bob Service, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Robert Service writes about efforts to develop advanced battery technologies for electric cars in a news focus in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, the online news editor of Science, is here with some of the latest science stories from our daily news site. First, Dave, the mental hazards of city life, something I suspect many of us can relate to.
Right. Well, Stuart, this study is all about whether living in a city is bad for your mental health. Now, there's been some studies that have suggested that people that live in cities, otherwise known as urbanites, have higher rates of schizophrenia, depression, anxiety, and other mental ailments. But the correlation has been a little unclear. And in this new study, researchers wanted to see if they could actually detect changes in brain activity between people that were living or raised in cities versus people from more rural areas.
And so what did they do?
Well, in this study, what they did was, this was actually a German study, so the researchers took volunteers from a variety of settings in Germany, from large cities, and these are places that had more than 100,000 people, from towns, which had about 10,000 people, and from rural areas, which were much more sparsely populated. And what they did was they had these volunteers sit in a machine called a functional magnetic resonance imaging machine, or fMRI. And this basically just measures activity in various parts of the brain. And they had these volunteers work on very difficult arithmetic problems. And while they were working on these problems, they saw a monitor, which is actually telling them how they were performing. And to make things even more stressful, what the researchers did was they made the monitor falsely show that these volunteers were performing very badly. And to actually make them even more stressed out, the researchers would call the volunteers in the middle of the experiment. They had a little link that they could communicate to the volunteers with. And they said, you're doing a really bad job, and this is a very expensive experiment, and we really need you to work harder. And that, of course, stressed the volunteers out even more.
Well, it all is sounding rather sadistic. What exactly came out of all of this?
Well, what they found was that they noticed a difference in the volunteers in a couple regions of the brain. One was the amygdala. For people that currently lived in a city, their amygdala showed a lot more activity while they were stressed out. And the amygdala has been shown to actually play a role in stress. So that kind of made sense. They also saw differences in activity in a region of the brain called the pterygeal anterior cingulate cortex, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, or PAC to be a little bit more succinct. This is a region thought to be involved in emotion and social processing, and it's also been implicated in some studies to schizophrenia. And in this region, researchers saw more activity in people that had been raised in a city, regardless of where they currently lived, but those that had been raised in a city showed more activity in this region during the experiments. And so what the researchers are inferring based on this data, even though it's fairly preliminary, is that people that were either raised or that currently live in urban environments are much more susceptible to stress than people that were either raised or currently living in more rural environments. And that could help explain why the people that live in cities tend to be more prone to conditions like schizophrenia, depression, and other anxiety disorders.
Well, I wonder, though, if you can really say that this is something about city life, or is it just something about the brains of the kind of people who end up living in cities?
Well, it's a really good question. And the researchers say they can't rule out that this is just a correlation and that city living isn't actually causing these conditions. But as you say, that people that are more prone to these conditions also end up living in cities. But the researchers do say they didn't see any correlations between brain activity and other measures of mood and personality or with demographic factors such as education or income. So they did try to do some controls, but they can't be 100% sure that this just might be a correlation that they're saying that living in a city may not be causative for these conditions.
And next, The Iceman's Last Meal. I'm assuming this isn't some long-lost Eugene O'Neill plot.
Right. The Iceman in question is a fellow by the name of Utsi, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And he died about 5,200 years ago in the Italian Alps. Now, researchers discovered Utsi in 1991. And over the past couple decades, they've really studied this guy to death and tried to learn as much as they can about the human beings that lived in the region during that time. And they've actually learned a lot. They've learned a lot about Neolithic life, and this is the period during which Utsi lived. They've learned about some of the customs and diet and things like that. And this new study is trying to tease out even more information from Utsi. And it turns out he still has a lot of surprises left to reveal.
Such as?
Well, one of the new things that they've discovered is they actually found his stomach for the first time. Previously, when they've been trying to figure out what he had eaten before he died, they actually looked in his bowels. But thanks to some advanced computer imaging, the researchers were able to isolate the stomach. And not only that, they were actually able to get into the stomach and remove some samples. And then they did some DNA testing on the samples. And what they found was that Utsi's stomach had a bunch of meat of the alpine ibex, which is an animal that frequents high elevations and whose body parts were once thought to possess medicinal qualities. So this tells us a little bit about what Utsi was eating right before he died. In fact, they estimate that he was eating ibex as little as 30 minutes right before he died.
Wow. And they looked at his teeth, too.
They looked at his teeth. They wanted to see how good his dental hygiene was. And turns out, not surprisingly, exactly, it was not very good. In fact, they found signs of periodontal disease and cavities. So Utsi wasn't much of a tooth brusher, which is not surprising, but definitely telling us, again, a little bit more about the personal habits of the people that lived in this region during this time. And the final thing they found, which was really interesting, is they were able to sequence Utsi's complete genome for the first time. Now, they're still trying to figure out exactly what all of this data is showing, but one of the first interesting things to come out of the sequence is that it looks like Utsi probably had brown eyes. Now, why this is interesting is if any of you have seen any reconstructions of Utsi, most of them depict him with blue eyes, but it turns out he may have had brown eyes instead. And the researchers hope that as they continue to analyze the DNA, they're going to even learn more about this ancient man. The DNA can give clues about what hereditary conditions he may have had, his susceptibility to particular diseases. And using this new technology they've actually used to sequence his genome, they're hoping they can decipher the genome of a lot of other ancient humans as well. For example, there's a 4,000-year-old human hair that's been preserved in Greenland's permafrost. So there may be a lot more ancient humans coming out of the woodwork thanks to this new technology and thanks to a lot of the new stuff we've been learning about Utsi.
But for now, we know the Iceman had brown eyes, bad teeth, and a stomach full of ibex.
Exactly.
Science marches on. Finally, a story about what's driving caribou to extinction in Western Canada.
Right, Stuart. This is actually a story that's been a mystery for a few years. The caribou in Western Canada, in a particular region of Western Canada, have been disappearing, and some say that they are close to extinction. And scientists really aren't sure why, but one of their primary suspects has been wolves that live in the region. In fact, there's been a movement to eradicate the wolves or to cull their numbers to help save the caribou. But in this new study, researchers wanted to figure out exactly what was going on. Now, traditionally, when wildlife biologists want to track populations, they use radio collars, they tag animals, they follow them over periods of time, and they try to estimate their numbers based on that. But in this new study, researchers had a different idea. They decided that they would learn more about caribou by studying their poop. And the way they did this was they actually trained a group of dogs to be able to recognize caribou poop and to be able to distinguish it from moose poop and wolf poop. So they sent these dogs out into the field, and these dogs ended up surveying an area of about 25,000 square kilometers. And when they identified poop or scat from a particular species, they'd sit down next to it, the researchers would collect it, and they would analyze it for various things like diet and stress hormones and other things like that. And basically what came out of all this analysis was that the researchers found that there were about 330 caribou in the region, which is actually twice as many as other researchers had suspected. Now, that doesn't mean the animals are safe, but it means that they're less endangered than some researchers had suspected. But even more importantly, they found that when they analyzed the samples of the wolf poop that they found that the wolves were not really dining on caribou. Caribou only made up about 10% of their diet. The rest of it was coming from deer and also a little bit from moose.
So the wolves have gotten sort of a bad rap here.
The wolves have definitely gotten a bad rap. It doesn't seem like they're really impacting the caribou population that much. In fact, what the researchers think is impacting the caribou populations based on the stress hormones that they measured in the caribou poop is humans. They found that caribou that tend to stick close to human sites, and there's a lot of human activity in this area. There's a lot of activity for drilling oil, and that can be very disruptive to the environment. And what the scientists find based on this scat analysis is that the caribou that tend to be hanging out close to humans tend to be much more stressed out, and this could help explain why some of these caribou are disappearing.
Well, what does this mean for conservation? You said they were going to cull the wolves. Is this going to change that?
Well, the researchers hope that A, this will take the blame off the wolves, and B, by putting the blame on the humans, that perhaps conservationists will convince the companies to maybe build the roads they're using in areas that the caribou don't like. And so the human activity can be separated from the caribou don't get as stressed out, and perhaps their population could recover.
Okay, Dave, what other stories are you looking into on the news site?
Well, Stuart, for Science Now, we've got a story about exomoons. These are moons that would be orbiting alien worlds, and why many more of them than thought may actually be habitable. Also, a story about how young monkeys interrupt each other when talking and how they grow out of this just like humans do, or at least most humans do. For Science Insider, Science's policy blog, we've got a story about measuring failure in science, a new paper coming out about quantifying failure in the laboratory, and also a story about a controversial program that had been proposed in the UK for using DNA to assess the nationality of various people and how scientists are weighing in on that debate. Finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science. This week, we've got a chat about who the first humans were. There's been some debate about when exactly the ancestors of our species first came on the scene and what they look like. We'll have a really great conversation with some expert scientists, so be sure to tune in for that and to check out all of these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the online news editor of Science. You can check out the latest science news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time. And that wraps up the June 24th, 2011 edition of the Science Podcast. Thanks to Andrew Green for his help with this week's show. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Stuart Wills. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.